In 2025, if you were looking for the absolute peak of real estate profitability in Europe, you'd probably think it was, I don't know, a Parisian flat. Or maybe like a high-rise in London.
Right, or a villa in Tuscany or something. That's the classic assumption.
Exactly. But it wasn't. It was actually in Moldova.
Yep, which is wild.
Literally wild. Today is April 13th, 2026, and if that fact completely upends how you think about European real estate, well, you are exactly who we are doing this deep dive for.
For sure, because Europe is still getting called the gold standard of real estate.
Hmm.
But it's not what people think it is.
No, it's not. We are taking this massive continent-wide puzzle, this landscape that people wrongly treat as just one giant uniform theme park of, you know, historical charm and espresso, and we are breaking it down.
And that is a critical distinction to make right away. Europe is not a monolith.
Right.
It is an incredibly complex, highly fractured landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And treating it like a single market is basically the fastest way to misallocate your capital.
Which brings us to our mission today. We are pulling apart the strategic guide to European real estate investment in 2025 to really just cut through the overwhelming noise.
There's a lot of noise.
So much noise. We want to figure out exactly why Europe is offering this bizarre, unique blend of high-yield tech booms, housing crises, and shifting tax havens.
And more importantly, how you can actually navigate this incredibly diverse continent without getting crushed by institutional giants.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if you are sitting at home looking at a map of Europe, trying to figure out where to even begin, like, how do you even categorize these markets?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, investing in Europe right now isn't about throwing a dart at a map. It's about ruthlessly aligning your specific financial goals with a hyper-specific micro-market.
Okay, so breaking it down into chunks.
Exactly. You have to categorize the continent into essentially two distinct theaters. On one side, you have your established Western markets, the heavy hitters.
The ones we always hear about.
Right. And on the other side, you have the emerging Eastern hubs. If your goal is to find a safe haven to park capital and ensure long-term wealth preservation, you're looking at those mature markets.
But if you want aggressive growth.
If you're chasing high rental yields, you absolutely have to look east.
So if I'm looking at Central and Eastern Europe, I should probably view them a bit like, I don't know, like high growth tech startups.
That's a great way to put it.
Like there's a massive upside, but I have to imagine there is a fundamentally different risk profile.
Oh, absolutely.
Because we just mentioned Moldova leading overall profitability due to favorable taxes. But then there's Riga, Latvia. The sources show Riga hitting an incredible residential rental yield of 8.47%.
Which is huge.
It's massive. But surely a yield that high doesn't just exist in a vacuum, right? Like, what is the actual mechanism driving that number?
Yeah, it definitely doesn't exist in a vacuum. Understanding that mechanism is exactly how you mitigate the startup level risk you just mentioned. That 8.47% yield in Riga is deeply tied to massive targeted urban development. Specifically, we're looking at the Skanste district.
Skanste.
Yeah. And this isn't just organic, slow neighborhood growth. It is a calculated municipal transformation. There are vast sums of infrastructure capital being injected into Skanste right now.
Just totally revamping the area.
Exactly. They are turning a formerly underutilized area into this modern, centralized business and residential hub.
Wow.
So when you buy into Riga right now, you aren't just buying an apartment. You're buying early equity in a district's transition.
I see. So the high yield is essentially your reward for taking on the risk of that ongoing transformation.
Precisely. You're getting paid a premium to be there before the dust settles and the market stabilizes.
That makes total sense. But let's pivot to the mature markets for a second.
The heavy hitters.
Yeah, the blue chip stocks of the continent. Because the numbers coming out of places like Spain and Germany, they don't look like slow, mature growth at all.
No, they really don't.
Like, the data shows Spain projecting a 23% growth in real estate for 2025. For a mature Western market, a 23% jump seems, I mean, almost contradictory.
It does seem totally counterintuitive.
Mm.
But it's actually driven by a confluence of macroeconomic unblocking.
Unblocking how?
Well, Spain's broader economic recovery has finally aligned with vastly improved lending conditions. Central banks started signaling rate stability, which allowed local lenders to unfreeze their mortgage products.
Ah, so people can actually borrow money again.
Exactly. Suddenly, domestic buyers who were completely priced out by all cash foreign investors a few years ago, they can re-enter the market. And that creates a massive surge in transaction volume.
Got it. And then there's Germany, which the sources say is showing a 59% year-over-year increase in property sales.
Right, a 59% spike. And the mechanism there is slightly different, but equally deliberate.
Because Germany is usually seen as the ultimate stable, slow-growth market, right?
Usually, yes. But that spike is driven by relaxed policies specifically designed to encourage lending for foreign investors. The government essentially streamlined the bureaucracy.
Making it easier to bring money in.
Exactly. They made it way easier for capital to flow into what is a famously stable economy. They're basically lubricating the gears of investment to ensure long-term stability.
I have to push back on that idea of German stability for a second, though.
Oh, okay, let's hear it.
Because if we drill down into Berlin specifically, the immediate picture from the data looks pretty bleak.
It does look rough on paper.
Yeah. Property values in Berlin have been decreasing, and there is a documented reduction in demand for office space entirely because of increased borrowing costs. Companies just aren't expanding their physical footprints.
Right.
So if values are dropping and offices are sitting empty, how can Berlin possibly remain a strong play for commercial investors?
Well, that is exactly the kind of surface-level contradiction that scares off amateur investors.
Okay, so what are the pros seeing?
Institutional investors aren't looking at the snapshot of today's borrowing costs. They are looking at a 10-year horizon. This is a classic countercyclical play.
Meaning they're deliberately swimming against the current.
Precisely. When borrowing costs rise, the casual buyers and overleveraged developers panic. They pull back. And what happens? Property values dip.
And then the big players swoop in.
Exactly. That dip is exactly when strategic investors acquire high-quality commercial assets at a steep discount. Because the underlying fundamentals of Berlin as a European economic powerhouse haven't actually changed.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's why you still see massive, hyper-modern commercial developments moving forward right now. Mm-hmm. Things like EDGE and the Eastside Tower.
And for those who might not be familiar, these are essentially next-generation, highly sustainable megastructures, right?
Exactly. They are premium, ESG-compliant office spaces. The investors funding these, they know that when borrowing costs eventually normalize, standard office space might still struggle.
Because people are still working from home, maybe.
Right. But highly sustainable, premium commercial hubs. Those will be in massive demand. They aren't buying today's reduced office demand. They are buying tomorrow's premium real estate while it's effectively on sale.
So you're buying the underlying asset at a discount.
Yep.
Which is actually a perfect segue into a realization I had while going through all this source material. It seems like looking at Europe country by country is almost a trap.
It is a massive trap.
You can't just pick a country. You really have to pick a specific sector within a specific city's economic climate.
We call that sector splitting. And it is really the only reliable way to read the market right now.
Sector splitting.
Yeah. A country's macroeconomy tells you the rules of the game, but the city-level sector tells you how to actually score points.
Let's use Dublin, Ireland to test that theory.
Perfect example.
Because Dublin is the European headquarters for huge tech giants like Google and Facebook. Mm. But the commercial real estate sector there is currently in a cooling period.
It is.
So if I just look at the commercial data, I might assume Dublin's tech boom is stalling out and I should just pack up my capital and leave.
But if you look across the street at the residential sector in Dublin, the temperature is entirely different.
It's completely flipped.
Exactly. While commercial expansion has cooled, residential property is experiencing significant growth.
Because of the current housing crisis in the area?
Right. And, you know, looking at this purely through the lens of market mechanics and maintaining total neutrality on the social side of things, a housing crisis is fundamentally a severe imbalance between supply and demand.
Right. The data just shows a bottleneck.
Exactly. You have tens of thousands of highly paid tech workers already living there, but local zoning or construction delays are limiting the creation of new high-density housing.
So the tech companies might not be building new office blocks today, but their employees still need a place to sleep tonight.
Exactly. That demographic stickiness is what creates the opportunity.
And the data shows that this specific imbalance in Dublin is generating yields of 6.83% for short-term residential investors.
This is incredible.
It really is. The commercial cooling and the residential heating are happening in the exact same city, totally independent of each other.
And relying on that intense demographic demand brings us nicely to Lisbon, Portugal, which is just a fascinating case study in how lifestyle desirability completely warps property values.
Warped is definitely the right word, because between 2016 and 2023, property values in Lisbon grew by 75% per square meter.
Just unbelievable growth.
A 75% increase in 7 years isn't just a hot market. That is a structural shift in the fundamental economics of the city.
It really is. Okay. It's largely driven by the climate, the coastline, and just this massive influx of foreign capital chasing that specific lifestyle.
The sources single out the Parque das Nações district.
Oh, yeah.
It's this very modern scenic area built along the water. And high demand means a roughly 112 square meter dwelling there now rents for an average of over 2,000 euros.
It is highly, highly lucrative. But, and this is a big poor way, but when an entire sector's growth is predicated heavily on lifestyle appeal and tourism, it introduces a very specific vulnerability.
Which is why we need to look at Barcelona.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because Barcelona has always been a gold mine for short-term vacation rentals due to its massive tourism draw.
Sure.
But in heavily tourist-driven areas across Europe, we're seeing this in places in France, Spain, and elsewhere, there is a significant rise in anti-tourist sentiment from the locals.
Right. And again, just looking at the market data.
Right. Purely analytical standpoint here. If you own a portfolio of short-term rentals in a city where the local population is actively pushing the government to crack down on tourism, how do you protect your investment? Like, do you just sell and run?
You don't necessarily sell. You restructure. You basically build a shock absorber into your portfolio through rental diversity.
Okay, how does that work in Barcelona?
Barcelona is a prime example of this hybrid strategy. The strategic move for 2025 isn't to go all in on short-term holiday lets.
Even with those crazy high summer yields.
Even then. The smart money balances those high-yield vacation properties with stable, long-term residential leases.
Ah, so you might rent a unit to, say, a digital nomad or a student on a 9-month medium-term lease.
Exactly. And then you capture the premium holiday rates during the 3 summer months.
Oh.
Or you just diversify across multiple properties.
By catering to both tourists and the local demographic, you hedge your regulatory risk.
Precisely. If the local government bows to pressure and suddenly restricts short-term rental licenses, those long-term leases provide a stable, legally protected floor for your income.
You're basically insulating yourself against the stroke of a politician's pen.
Exactly.
But man, speaking of the stroke of a pen, finding the perfect hybrid strategy in Barcelona or the best yield in Riga is completely useless if you aren't legally allowed to invest.
Or if the tax structure just evaporates all your profits.
Right. The regulatory environment.
It is the invisible ceiling on every single investment.
It really is. I mean, looking at the regulations across Europe feels less like reading an economic report and more like, I don't know, playing a complex board game where the rules change depending on which square you land on.
That's a great analogy. Or like a massive hydraulic system.
Oh, a hydraulic system, I like that.
Yeah, where a government closes a valve in one area to restrict pressure, but then opens a completely different valve somewhere else to let the capital flow.
Let's look at the famous golden visa as an example of that. It's the policy where you can essentially secure European residency just by buying real estate. The valves on this are turning aggressively right now.
The golden visa landscape is undergoing a massive realignment.
Mm.
Historically, it was just this blunt instrument to attract foreign capital.
Just buy a house, get a visa.
Exactly. But now, policies are diverging sharply based on what each country actually needs internally.
Like in Greece and Cyprus, the sources say the golden visa is still highly active.
Right. They are keeping that valve open. They want to attract investors who prioritize residency. But Spain is actively altering their parameters.
And Portugal has completely phased out the golden visa for property investments, right?
They have. Meanwhile, Italy is operating a different mechanism altogether. They offer an elective residency visa, which focuses on your passive income rather than forcing you to buy a specific piece of property.
Wait, let's look at Portugal for a second. If they completely shut off the golden visa valve for property, why hasn't foreign investment completely dried up there?
Because of that hydraulic system we were talking about. Governments use these rules as precise levers to direct capital. Portugal realized that tying residency directly to property purchases was dangerously inflating their local housing market.
So they removed the visa incentive to cool it down.
Exactly.
Mm.
But to prevent a total collapse of foreign investment, they replaced it with aggressive tax incentives for foreign investors.
Ah, So they took away the residency carrot, but offered a massive tax break carrot in its place.
They fine-tuned the machinery.
And that machinery changes drastically depending on where you look on the map. Like, France has zero restrictions on foreign ownership. But they hit you with high property and vacancy taxes in certain regions. Germany also has no foreign ownership restrictions, but they apply a capital gains tax.
And Spain hits you with both wealth taxes and capital gains taxes.
And beyond the taxes, there are the operational frictions, like the language and cultural barriers, which I think people seriously underestimate.
Oh, it's a huge factor.
In major German cities or the coastal expat hubs of Portugal, English is the language of business. You can navigate the system pretty easily.
Sure.
But if your strategy relies on finding hidden value in rural Italy, the language barrier is a brick wall.
Absolutely. You cannot execute those deals without highly competent, multilingual local agents who actually understand the unwritten rules of their specific municipality.
That's so true.
And what's fascinating here is that the average investor views this whole maze of taxes, shifting visas, and local customs as a deterrent.
It's intimidating.
But sophisticated investors view these complexities as a moat. If you are willing to learn the intricacies of the local tax code, you can find the inefficiencies and the incentives that everybody else misses.
Okay, so let's talk about those sophisticated investors and how they are actually executing in 2025. Because there is a number in our research that genuinely gave me pause.
Let me guess. Blackstone.
Blackstone. Specifically, Blackstone's real estate partners, Europe 7th. It is the largest fund in Europe. And they have raised 9.8 billion euros in capital commitment for 2025.
Nearly 10 billion euros ready to be deployed.
Exactly. If you are listening to this right now, looking at your own portfolio, hearing a number like 10 billion euros makes you feel like you shouldn't even bother trying.
Yeah, it sounds impossible to go up against.
How does an everyday investor, or even like a mid-level syndicate, compete in a landscape dominated by a financial leviathan?
By realizing that you are actually playing a totally different game. You do not compete with Blackstone's wallet. You compete with agility.
Agility. Because they're too big to move fast.
Exactly. A fund that size cannot maneuver into micro opportunities. They have to deploy capital in massive sweeping chunks. As an everyday investor, you can target hyperlocal anomalies.
The needle in the haystack.
Right. But to do that, you have to arm yourself with the same level of institutional knowledge. The data outlines specific tools you must utilize. Platforms like CBRE and Savills, which provide high-level, institutional-grade macroeconomic reports.
You essentially have to read what the giants are reading.
Exactly. And you pair that with spatial data platforms like Gamma.
Gamma. What does that do?
Well, you aren't just looking at a flat map anymore. You are looking at overlapping data layers. Where are the new transit lines being approved? Where are the demographic shifts happening, block by block?
You combine that private data with official government macroeconomic indicators?
Yep. Use the data to spot the red flags before the market actually prices them in.
And the biggest red flag highlighted right now in the sources is oversupply.
It's a killer.
Because the value of your asset is almost entirely attributed to scarcity, right? If you buy into an emerging market just as they finish constructing 10,000 new units right down the street, your rental yields and property values are just going to plummet.
Oversupply kills scarcity every time. The other critical red flags are broader economic instability in the region and missing the regulatory shifts we just discussed.
Like the short-term rental bans.
Right. If you buy a property, modeling your returns entirely on short-term holiday rates, and then the city council bans short-term rentals a month later, your entire financial model just collapses.
Which means timing the market isn't just about buying the dip. It's about anticipating policy and demographic trends.
Yes.
Like, we are seeing a massive rise in remote worker visas, highly popular in Spain right now, and there's growing digital nomad interest in places like France and Germany.
And that completely changes the profile of the tenant you are building your strategy around.
So what does this all mean? If a listener is ready to deploy capital today into this massive, fractured European landscape, how should they categorize their strategy?
Well, it demands total clarity on your time horizon. If your strategy is short-term, meaning you require immediate, high cash flow to justify the investment, you must chase the high-demand, high-yield friction zones.
So the emerging markets.
Exactly. You look toward markets like Riga to capture that 8.47% yield during its transformation. Or you tap into that severe residential supply-demand imbalance in Dublin, capturing that 6.83% yield while the housing crisis persists.
But if you are playing the long game,
If you are a long-term investor, your priority is resilience. You are looking for stable economies and steady compounding appreciation.
The heavy hitters.
Right. That means you pivot to the mature markets. You look at the Netherlands or you look in Germany, where that 59% increase in transaction volume shows a profound underlying institutional confidence in the market's long-term stability.
You accept lower immediate yields in exchange for knowing the asset is protected by a fortress economy.
Exactly.
It really is an incredible menu of options once you know how to read it. Let's recap what we've unpacked today.
Let's do it.
The idea of Europe as a single, charming real estate market is just a myth. It is a highly dynamic machine in 2025. You can ride the momentum of Spain's 23% growth, fueled by rebounding lending.
Yep.
You can capture massive yields in the municipal transformations of Latvia. Or you can play the sophisticated, long-term countercycle, buying premium commercial assets in Berlin at a discount while everyone else is paralyzed by borrowing costs.
And the ultimate advantage of navigating this complexity is true portfolio diversification.
Because they aren't tied to the exact same economic forces.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By spreading your capital across these completely different economic microclimates, you leverage the overarching stability of the euro while using the internal friction of the continent to hedge against global volatility.
You aren't just buying property, you are engineering a highly resilient wealth vehicle.
Well said.
But doing that requires ignoring the cliches. You have to learn the local tax structures, monitor the hydraulic valves of the Golden Visa programs, and use spatial data to stay ahead of the supply curve.
It does raise an important question, though. It's something we should probably leave you to think about.
Oh.
Yeah, we've spent all this time breaking down the mechanics, the yields, the tax incentives, the structural strategies, but consider the sheer physical scale of what is actually unfolding.
It is massive.
Massive institutional funds are pouring 10 billion euros at a time into these cities. Simultaneously, a wave of high-earning digital nomads and remote workers are flocking to the coastlines, drawn by the climate, the culture, and the lifestyle.
The very things that make Europe, Europe.
Exactly. But as global investment capital relentlessly optimizes these markets, and as foreign remote workers absorb the local housing supply, it creates a profound and growing tension with the people who actually live there.
Wow. Yeah.
So the ultimate question is, how will this immense financial pressure reshape the very desirable lifestyle and historical charm that makes European real estate so valuable in the first place? If global capital completely commodifies the charm of these cities, what exactly are we investing in 20 years from now?
That is a phenomenal thought to sit with. Does the act of buying the charm inevitably destroy it? We'll leave you to ponder that one. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the 2025 European real estate landscape. Keep looking past the headlines, keep analyzing those local trends, and we'll catch you next time.